Chapter 1. Fluids. The scientific study of fluid motion, fluid mechanics, has long been motivated by two purposes. We all want to understand the world around us, and since our world is dominated by the presence of fluids, it is full of fundamental questions involving fluid motion. How can aeroplanes fly? Why do waves break? Why doesn't water wet lotus leaves? Fluid flows also affect many aspects of the industrial world. There is therefore an ongoing commercial need to quantify fluid behaviour, predict it, and manage the interactions between fluids and their environments. Practical questions abound for which fluid mechanics is the key. Can we reduce drag on aeroplanes? How should surfboards be designed? Can we use lotus leaf technology to create waterproof clothes? In this first chapter, we start by considering the structure of fluids and discuss some of the remarkable properties they display, even in the absence of flow. Fluids and molecules. The first logical question to ask is, what exactly is a fluid? One natural way to answer this question is to look in detail at the molecular structure of the three familiar states of matter. Both liquids and gases are fluids. In the solid state, individual particles, be they atoms, molecules, or even charged particles called ions, are held together by strong forces and arranged in a very regular symmetrical pattern called a crystal, which is periodically repeated over the entire length of the solid. The individual particles in a crystal cannot move, and this explains why solids have a rigid structure. In contrast, particles in liquids and gases can move freely. In the case of liquids, particles are very close to each other, but they are constantly jiggling around, and many rearrange in response to external forces. The molecular structure of liquids therefore allows them to flow. The most fundamental of all liquids is, of course, water, while blood is an example of a complex liquid vital to animal life. The molecular structure of gases is very different from that of liquids, and yet gases are also fluids. In a gas, particles are widely separated and almost don't interact with one another, except for occasional collisions. But particles are able to move in response to forces, and therefore gases do flow. The air in our surrounding atmosphere hides in plain sight, but clouds can be used to visualise its motion, while fire is an example of a gas flowing while undergoing chemical reactions. The stark difference between the molecular structure of liquids and gases has some important consequences. For example, it is much easier to compress a gas than it is to compress a liquid, since gases have a lot of free space between particles, whereas liquids have almost none. Solids and liquids also tend to be very similar in weight, whereas gases are, of course, much lighter. So one could argue that, from a molecular standpoint, liquids very much resemble solids. But in terms of their ability to deform in response to external forces and to flow, liquids and gases are very similar, and both are fluids. Macroscopic fluids. The problem with a molecular answer to the definition of a fluid is that it is not very satisfying. In our everyday experience, most of us do not apprehend reality with molecular glasses, so there must be a way to define a fluid without having to resort to molecular concepts. Counterintuitively, it is easier to define what is not a fluid. The opposite of a fluid is called a solid, a material that has a fixed shape and is able to keep it permanently. A solid can often deform if an external force is applied to it, but when the force is removed, the solid returns to its original shape with no permanent change to its state. Picture a trampoline or a sponge. You can try as hard as you can to deform them. They will always bounce back. A fluid is what is not a solid, and therefore it has the opposite characteristics. A fluid does not have a fixed shape, but constantly changes its shape in order to adapt to the form of its surroundings. A fluid flows continuously under the action of an imposed force, and this deformation is permanent with no memory of where it started. Both of these statements apply equally to liquids, for example, water in the ocean or in a cup of tea, and gases, for example, the air surrounding us. Thus, both liquids and gases are fluids. Alternatively, scientists like to say that fluids are defined as materials that cannot sustain shear forces. While we will focus on shear in Chapter 2, the intuitive way to think about it is to imagine depositing a drop of saliva between your thumb and another finger. If you slide one finger relative to the other, the saliva flows continuously and, in fact, If you had infinite fingers and infinite saliva, you could do this forever. In contrast, if you deposit a small piece of wood or a mobile phone between your fingers and try to slide without slipping, the material resists the deformation. Solids cannot be sheared, but fluids can. As with all scientific classification, exceptions exist. The distinction outlined earlier separates simple solids from simple fluids. In contrast, complex fluids are materials that share some characteristics with both fluids and solids. For example, shaving foams or gels can flow, but they retain some memory of their initial state. Similarly, toothpaste has a fixed shape when deposited on a toothbrush, and yet it offers very little resistance to being rubbed against our teeth. The continuum hypothesis. When we look at a table, we don't see the molecules that constitute it and their continuous vibrations. Instead, we see a piece of material that is uniform and at rest. The same is true for water in a glass, which fills all of the space available to it in a continuous fashion. Yet we know that vibrating particles are the fundamental constituents of matter. With a sufficiently powerful zoom, every material would appear to us as made up of discrete elements constantly moving around and interacting with one another. How is it possible that a fluid can then both be made of many distinct elements and yet appear to us as continuous and smooth? The response to this lies in the concept of averaging. To gain intuition, let us first consider the case of sand. The prototypical example of a granular material, sand is made up of individual sand grains. Each grain has a slightly different shape, a different colour, and originates from a slightly different rock and mineral. The sand is also being moved around by wind or by children running on it. Yet when we drive up to the beach and see the sand dunes in the horizon, the same sand appears to us to be completely uniform and smooth, and we don't see its motion at all. The difference between holding sand in your hand and seeing sand from your car is therefore one length of scale. In the first case, you are looking at the sand a few centimetres away from it and can resolve the motion of its grains, while in the other case, you are kilometres away from it and every little sand movement is averaging out to zero. So depending on the length scale at which we appreciate the material, it can appear to be spatially discrete and moving around, or spatially continuous and at rest. What is true for sand is similarly true for a fluid. Molecules in the glass of water constantly move around and collide with one another. But if we zoom out, we average their motion on length scales much larger than the distance between the molecules, and obtain zero net motion and a continuous material. Scientists call these types of materials a continuum, and the branch of physics devoted to quantifying how they deform in response to forces is known as continuum mechanics. A continuum fluid, the one that is intuitively known to us, is thus one obtained by ignoring its discrete nature and by averaging the motion of its molecules with that of its neighbours. How exactly should this averaging be done? If we average over too few neighbours, the fluid motion will still include some trace of the molecular randomness. At the other end, if we average over too many molecules, we will not be able to resolve the well-defined length scales that characterise fluid motion. For example, to describe water waves crashing on a beach, we need to capture the typical length scales between each wave, the typical height, but also the fine features of the water droplets that are produced when waves break. Scientists have been able to probe this question using controlled experiments on minute amounts of fluids. Simple liquids, such as water, behave as a smooth continuum as soon as the length scales in the fluid exceed a few nanometers. It takes 10 to the power of 9 nanometers to make a meter. Since the typical molecular size is a tenth of a nanometer, it means that averaging motion over a few tens of individual particles gives rise to a continuum liquid. The situation in gases is similar, but since the typical distance between gas molecules is much larger than in liquids, the averaging length scales are larger. For example, gas molecules in air travel on average 50 nanometers between successive collisions. The continuum approximation tends, therefore, to be valid for gases on length scales of micrometers or more. It takes 10 to the power of 6 micrometers to make a meter, and thus 10 to the power of 3 nanometers to make a micrometer. Notwithstanding exceptions, such as the upper parts of the atmosphere where air is rarefied and gas molecules have to travel much more between collisions, All fluids on human length scales, say millimetres or more, are safely in the continuum limit. This is the limit we will focus on in this book. In particular, it means that we will be able to refer to the properties of the fluid at a particular point of space and time. For example, its velocity, with the implicit assumption that it means the local value averaged over a few tens of fluid particles. Pressure. Fluid mechanics is mostly focused on the study of fluids that are deformed and flow, and as a result the field is often called fluid dynamics. But even in the absence of motion, fluids have remarkable characteristics. When they do not move, fluids are said to be at equilibrium, and their study is that of fluid statics. One of the most important properties of fluids at equilibrium is their ability to sustain and to exert pressure. Imagine putting a volume of a liquid in a large container and covering the fluid with a tight-fitting lid, that is, one that does not allow any fluid to escape on the sides. If it wasn't for the fluid, the lid would be free to slide up and down the sides of the container like a piston. If you then place a heavy weight on the lid, this weight exerts a force on the fluid, represented by the black arrow pointing downward in Figure 2a. If the fluid is a liquid, the presence of the weight leads to no visible change because liquids are essentially incompressible. Since the lid does not move at all, it means that the sum of the forces acting on it must be zero. Consequently, a force equal and opposite to the external force acting on the lid must be applied by the liquid, as represented by the grey upward arrow in Figure 2a. We have thus uncovered a remarkable property of a liquid. If you push on it, it is able to push back by exactly the same amount. Push harder, and the fluid will also push harder. The ability of a liquid at rest to generate a force in response to an external push is referred to as pressure. The value of the external force acting in Figure 2a, divided by the surface area over which the force is applied, gives a number called the external pressure. In response to this external pressure, liquids have the ability to generate an identical internal pressure, whatever its value. In fact, this is also true if the external pressure is negative, that is, if the direction of the external force in Figure 2a is reversed. If you pull on a liquid, the liquid will pull back by the same amount, and it is then said to be under tension. If, instead of a liquid, the fluid in the container is a gas, the behaviour is slightly different. Consider first an open container. The liquid in the container is composed of moving particles, and they collide frequently with the walls of the container, exerting a force on them. The value of this force, divided by the surface area on which it acts, is the pressure in the gas. Incidentally, this is the same value you would measure in a liquid placed in the container but with no lid on, and is due to the external pressure generated by the collisions between the surrounding air and the surface of the liquid. Now imagine placing the tight-fitting lid on the air-filled container as we did in the case of a liquid, and applying an external downward force to it, for example by using a weight. In contrast with liquids, gases are compressible, and therefore the lid moves down a small amount. As the lid slides down, the volume available to the air trapped in the container decreases, so the particles in the closed container have a bit less space and thus collide more often with the sides of the container. This in turn means that the pressure in the container increases. As the lid continues to move down, at some point the increase in gas pressure will be sufficiently large that the force applied by the gas in the container on the lid will be equal to the external force. At that point, the forces on the lid balance and it stops moving. The end result is similar to the case of a liquid. If you push on a gas, it is eventually able to push back by the same amount, with the difference that the gas gets compressed in the process so as to balance the external forces applied to it. In addition to being able to adapt in response to external conditions, the pressure in a fluid has another important property. No matter which direction you look, the pressure has the same value. Isotropy is the term used to describe this property, and the pressure in the fluid is said to be isotropic. We can describe this feature using another thought experiment. Imagine quantifying the value of the pressure in the compressed gas of Figure 2b by placing a small flat probe inside the container and measuring the force exerted by gas molecules colliding with it. The measured pressure is equal to the value of this force divided by the area of the probe. If you place the probe at one point, measure the pressure, and then rotate the probe in place and redo the measurement, you will obtain the same pressure value. Repeat with any rotation in three-dimensional space, and the measurement for the pressure is always the same. Pressure acts, therefore, in all directions with the same magnitude. This property of pressure isotropy is called the law of pressure and is originally due to the work of the 17th century French mathematician Blaise Pascal. Today, Pascal is mostly known to the general public for his work on philosophy, and in particular, his scientific argument for believing in God. Pascal's last name is now used as the unit of pressure, with 1 pascal of pressure, 1 Pa, equal to a weight of 1 kilogram acting over 1 square meter. Pressure in the air surrounding us under normal room temperature conditions and at sea level is approximately 100,000 Pa. Hydrostatics. We discussed how the pressure in a fluid can result from an externally applied force. A lid with a weight on it pushes on the fluid, which pushes back. But the force generating the fluid pressure does not have to be externally imposed, and in fact it can arise from the fluid itself. Indeed, fluids, just like everything around us, are subject to the unavoidable force of gravity. Gravity is one of the fundamental forces of nature. As originally derived by the 17th century English mathematician Isaac Newton, one of the most influential scientists of all time, two objects with a mass always attract each other with a gravitational force proportional to the product of their masses. On Earth, a body of mass, m, small, compared to that of the Earth, experiences a downward force due to its gravitational attraction by Earth, called the weight, capital W, of magnitude, capital W is equal to mg, where g is the acceleration due to gravity, approximately a constant value on Earth. Applied to a fluid, the presence of this gravitational force means that each small parcel of fluid experiences its own downward force, with a rather dramatic consequence for the state of pressure in the fluid. Consider, for example, a liquid in a container and imagine drawing an invisible horizontal surface somewhere in it. The fluid located between the top surface and the invisible horizontal surface is at equilibrium, so the sum of all the vertical forces acting on it must be zero. That fluid is subject to two downward forces, the total weight of the liquid plus the force from the external air pressure. Balancing these two downward forces is the upward force from the fluid pressure immediately underneath the invisible horizontal surface. The pressure in the liquid, therefore, needs to balance the weight. However, the value of the weight depends on where we draw our invisible horizontal surface. If the surface is drawn near the top, the weight is small, and therefore the fluid pressure is almost that of the external air pressure. In contrast, if we draw the surface near the bottom of the container, the fluid weight is large, so the pressure must also increase a lot. As a result of gravity, the pressure in the liquid is therefore not constant, but increases with depth. These arguments of force balance can be used to calculate the spatial dependence of the pressure exactly. Let us denote by P, open parenthesis H, close parenthesis, the value of the pressure in the fluid at a depth, H, below the top surface, and P, sub-top, the value of the pressure at the very top, equal to the air pressure. We use rho to denote the mass density of the liquid, that is, the mass of 1 cubic meter of fluid, and we assume that it is constant throughout the fluid. For a liquid such as water, we have rho sub water is approximately equal to 1,000 kilograms per meter cubed, while a gas such as air has a much smaller density. Rho sub air is approximately equal to 1.2 kilograms per meter cubed. The force balance on the total amount of fluid located between the top surface and the virtual surface located at a depth h below can be expressed mathematically. If the surface has a total area capital A, the fluid volume is capital AH, and thus its mass is m, is equal to rho capital AH. The two downward forces acting on the fluid are therefore the weight, mg, and the force from the pressure at the very top, P sub top, capital A. To balance these forces is the upward resisting force due to the fluid pressure of magnitude P, open parenthesis, H, close parenthesis, capital A. The equilibrium between these two forces means that P, open parenthesis, H, close parenthesis, capital A, is equal to P sub top capital A plus rho G H capital A, which results in equation 1. This is the law of hydrostatic pressure, showing that the pressure in the liquid increases linearly with depth. This increase can lead to the generation of very large pressures. For example, scuba divers descending in the ocean experience 10,000 pascals of added pressure for every meter of swimming below the surface. Human beings are known to be very sensitive to changes in pressure, and even casual swimmers diving to reach a toy at the bottom of a swimming pool experience the feeling of compression in their ears due to the increase in hydrostatic pressure. Equivalently, if pressure increases with depth, it also means that it decreases with height. For example, the pressure in the atmosphere decreases as one moves upward, explaining the need for aeroplanes to maintain cabin pressure during flight. Similarly, in plants, the fact that the pressure in the vascular system is approximately atmospheric near the plant roots, and that it decreases with height, from roots to stems, means that the pressure can reach values significantly below atmospheric for tall trees. That pressure can even become negative. The law of hydrostatic pressure leads to the other remarkable property that the pressure only depends on the height, h, below the top surface, and has no horizontal dependence. The size of the container used to generate hydrostatic pressures is irrelevant, and if, instead of a large bucket, one uses a small, tall tube, identical fluid pressures can be induced using much smaller amounts of liquids. This is the principle exploited by an invention called the hydraulic press, whereby hydrostatic pressures combined with large surfaces are used to generate large forces and lift very heavy objects. Legend has it that Pascal himself used the large hydrostatic pressure generated in a tall, thin tube to burst open a large wooden barrel. Buoyancy. The fact that the pressure in a fluid increases with depth leads to another important concept, that of buoyancy. This is illustrated in Figure 3b, which can be found in the print version of the book. Take a rubber duck initially located outside a liquid container and proceed to completely submerge it in the fluid. To keep the toy immersed, one needs to apply a downward force to it. This is because, when the rubber duck is inside the liquid, it is subject to the same distribution of hydrostatic pressure as if it were not present in the fluid. The fluid pressure continues to increase with depth, and therefore the pressures pushing the duck down is lower than that pushing it back up, resulting in a net force. This force, due to the displaced fluid, is called the buoyancy force, and its magnitude is exactly equal to the weight of the fluid displaced by the rubber duck. Indeed, if the duck was not in the fluid, the weight of the fluid would balance the pressure distribution on its surface. If you remove the fluid but replace it by the duck, the pressure distribution remains identical, and thus it continues to apply the same force, equal to the opposite to the weight of the fluid. This remarkable result is famously associated with Archimedes in ancient Greece. Long fascinated by geometry and mechanics, Archimedes was confronted with the problem of measuring the volume of an irregular shape, a crown. As he was taking a bath and saw the water rise as he entered the water, he discovered that the measurement could be done by immersing the crown in a liquid and measuring the volume of the displaced fluid. Legend has it that Archimedes then ran through the streets of Syracuse, Sicily, screaming "Eureka!" now the established motto for scientific discoveries. Surface tension. Another important property of liquids at equilibrium is their cohesion. Consider a water droplet, for example a small raindrop, attached to your window or your windshield. We all know that droplets tend to be round. In fact, if the droplet is small enough, it will be exactly spherical. If now this droplet is sandwiched between two surfaces, then external forces must be applied in order to squeeze the droplet into a thin pancake shape. If these forces are relaxed, then the droplet will return to its original spherical shape. In other words, the droplet has the inherent property to want to remain round. This cohesive property is called surface tension, and it has a molecular origin. Particles in the liquid interact with their neighbours through long-ranged attractive forces. It is therefore energetically favourable for a given particle to have as many neighbours as possible, so as to decrease the overall internal molecular energy in the liquid. Particles in the middle of a liquid are surrounded by neighbours on all sides and have the minimum energy possible. In contrast, Particles on the surface of a liquid only have neighbours on one side, the liquid side. Compared to their friends deep into the liquid, surface particles are therefore missing out on half of potential molecular interactions. It is therefore energetically unfavourable for the fluid to have too many particles on the surface, and the lowest energy state is obtained when the fluid has the smallest surface area possible, so as to have as few surface particles as possible. We therefore see that there is an energetic cost associated with increasing the surface area of the liquid. In order to increase the surface area, one needs to provide external energy, and this is why external forces are required in order to squeeze the droplet in Figure 4a. The surface tension of the liquid measures the energy of the liquid per unit of surface area. If surface tension were the only energy to consider, then drops would always be spherical, since a sphere is the geometrical shape with the minimum surface area for a given volume. This is famously the case in space, and astronauts have long entertained us with pictures of large floating balls of various beverages. Wetting. The surface energy of a liquid arises from the intermolecular interactions between fluid particles. When a fluid drop is put in contact with a rigid surface, an additional source of energy comes into play, namely that due to interactions between fluid and surface particles. Depending on the natures of both the liquid and the surface, fluid particles might favour interactions with other fluid particles over surface particles, or the opposite might be true, and it might be energetically advantageous for the liquid to interact strongly with the surface instead of with itself. The branch of fluid mechanics studying the consequence of these interactions is called wetting. Two broad categories of wetting behaviours can be distinguished. In the first type, called complete wetting, interactions with the surface are so favourable that the liquid spreads completely on the surface. This is a rather unusual case, but happens, for example, for water on ultra-clean glass. More common is the second situation, called partial wetting, where a small droplet, deposited on the surface, spreads until it takes the form of a portion of a sphere. The angle between the liquid surface and the rigid wall, measured inside the liquid, is called the contact angle. If that angle is acute, the surface is called hydrophilic, and the droplet is less than half a sphere. This is the most common case in our everyday experience, happening, for example, for water on most metallic surfaces, or treated glass, such as windows or windshields. If instead the contact angle is obtuse, the surface is said to be hydrophobic, so the drop is now more than half a sphere, with the most familiar example being water on plant leaves. The science of wetting is associated with the work of two illustrious scientists at the very beginning of the 19th century. Pierre-Simon Laplace was a French mathematician who derived an important equation showing that the presence of surface tension leads to an increase in pressure inside fluids with curved surfaces. He is now most famous for his work on the orbits of planets and for mathematical techniques. The Laplace transform is a classical method used to integrate differential equations. Not long after Laplace, the British physician and physicist Thomas Young worked on wetting, and he derived a formula predicting the contact angle of a liquid as a function of the surface energies of the materials involved. Also well known for his work on light, Young's name is famously associated with the mechanics of solids, and indeed the deformability of an elastic material is measured by its Young's modulus.